Welcome everybody to our 10th group session of Practical Work on Self. We're ready to start, and we're getting started today with one small habit. I'd like to first, before we go into one small habit, I'd like to ask if there are any questions regarding last week's discussion on harmless whim.
Yeah, there's a blast from the past here. And we have an email from Mike Williamson that I'd like to read. see, it came in a couple of days ago, I guess. Comment. Can I understand in my own experiencing the two statements below from Practical Work on Self? First, small things we do not really want for ourselves are the only things we can really call a whim. Second, to compel the machine to do one small thing not desired by our organism or personality, and also not automatic in the condition of the organism, gives us a taste of real will on a small scale. And then he goes on, for example, what does it mean to compel the machine to do one small thing? What sort of force is involved with this? Does to compel the machine require that we have at least one eye open to the fact that there can be a separation, non-entanglement, between the part of our nature that is still non-phenomenal self, or simple presence, and able to see, and the part that is moving and cannot see for itself, phenomenal self, human biological machine? Can we notice the taste of real will on a small scale as we experiment with the undertaking of a small whim? There you go. Did that come through okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Diana, did you get clearer about that distinction about the harmless whim? We were talking about that the other day.
Actually, I was going to ask for a little more help. I was kind of just listening to Mike's comment. I want to make sure, I don't know if I'm overthinking it or just not fully grasping it. What I was trying to do this week was create a new habit, and this is how far I got in the time to help me. I tried to start just rubbing my chin, which is a habit I don't normally cultivate, but I thought I would just start stroking my chin to see what emotion it invoked, or could I create some sort of involuntary reaction with it. And I got as far as going, what an interesting distraction when I was doing it, because I realized when I was doing that, it took me away from thinking about other things or probably, you know, reverting to my own mechanicalities. And that's as far as I got in trying this.
That's okay. A good place to get to.
Yeah. I think if we go back to the chapter and we remember it a little bit, one of the objectives of it is to begin to get a taste for this concept called real will. So in this case, we're not selecting a whim, or we're not selecting a mechanical habit so much that we have, but something that might be interesting, like rubbing your chin. Or I think we got a taste of that from Mike many, many weeks ago when he was at a stoplight. Is that correct, Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah. But he did it, he noticed it not as a whim for himself, wasn't an exercise of real will at that time. That was a mechanical thing. So if we adopt it like that, Diana, then it's like, let me try this on. So the very nature of trying it on like that is a is a form of exercising the real will at that time.
David, to follow this out a little, like a few more, like I said, I spent the week doing this because I just wanted to try it, hoping at some point I would understand the emotion behind it. If I stuck with this habit for an extended period of time, would I get to the point where I would actually understand the emotion behind it? So I, let's say, know what Mike's doing when Mike is stroking his beard, much as if Mike were to adopt one of my habits of, you know, chewing on my tongue or putting my hands on my lips. Would he at some point come to understand what's happening inside of me in doing in physical mechanicality?
Boy, my initial answer to that is no, because when we are putting on a whim, we're not reactive from the point of view of an emotion. We're not in reactivity, and this is how it comes out in my physical mechanicality. We are literally just doing it. And it does have a certain form to it, and it has a certain mood, is maybe a better way to put it.
Okay.
Yeah, this is an actor's trick, too.
That's right. I remember you all said that.
Yeah.
I think you might find that you had a little bit more overlap with what Mike might be feeling. It might come from a totally different place, or it could bring out similar feelings. It would depend on how close your natures were in resonance. And the more closely your natures resonate, the greater the extent that you would begin to feel some of the same things.
Okay, that makes sense too. Yeah, I guess I'm just kind of curious. The reason I'm hesitant is I'm not sure where to go from here, and I feel like I started something that maybe over some period of time would come to completion, or is it just to give me a sense of noticing that that was a distraction? I realize, even though I have yet to be able to follow through all my mechanicalities, I'm assuming part of the point of the exercise was to realize how much most of what we do is just a distraction.
Well, the point of this exercise is not to create a distraction.
Right.
It's not. We're not trying to. There are many ways to create distractions. Literally, the point in the chapter is to get a sense, and what does it feel like in your being to exercise your will?
Okay.
And you stand in a different place at that point. You're on different ground. I mean, dare I say, I think it's Isaiah, you know, you stand on holy ground at that moment. So where is that? What is it like? What does it feel like? Will I notice it in other places? How will you know unless you have a bit of a sense of it? So we're trying to say, here is a simple way to, not because we're trying to rub our chins, but because we're trying to see, I intend to do this. And it's your intentionality then that rises forth.
Oh.
So Silverdale has added something I'd like to interject it here. The historical personality is, in sum and in short, a body of mechanical habits from conception to our last breath. The non-phenomenal self has no habits until they're consciously and intentionally created, one small habit at a time. The non-phenomenal self experiences itself as undifferentiated unity and must be educated how to, in accordance with its nature, to differentiate this unity.
Yeah, and let me expand on that last part. we think because we have a resonance to quote-unquote higher things that we know what it is. This is practical work on self. So we're taking exercises to actually practice being in that other place. And as Silverdale is telling us, he's using the phrase, how to be in the non-phenomenal self, which is experienced as an undifferentiated unity. Mm-hmm. Nice, huh? Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Hello? What's it like to be in undifferentiated unity? Well, let's practice.
So, and on the way to that, creating one small habit at a time is a way of gaining leverage in terms of attention and in terms of waking up the mechanical self.
Okay, chapter 8 is called Harmless Whim, and then chapter 9 is One Small Habit. Two different processes,
okay,
but they're very much associated with our voyage here, with our wonderful voyage.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
I'm still pondering. You know, last week we were talking about, because I know Silverdale keeps talking about the three forces, and that ultimately we get to the state of unity and divinity. And I had a moment 2 days ago, so you had a pretty powerful phone call, where I actually, got to do a little work with my inner infant. And when you and I finished our session, I was just kind of laying still on the couch, and I had an interesting experience of a sense of internal harmony and actually external harmony, in that I felt, say, connected to my neighborhood.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that that's probably a pretty close version, even though I realize that's not the ultimate of divinity and enlightenment. But I thought, oh, wow, maybe this is what we've been talking about, you know, as in what I'm aspiring to.
Are you saying that you felt an expansion of your awareness from outside of its normal confines?
There you go. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
What's your question?
I guess the question was, I'm assuming that that's beginning phases of what Silverdale's been talking about, or what we've been talking about in this course.
It's probably barking up the right tree.
Okay, I know. You got to keep it simple for me.
Let's just say that's potentially in the right neighborhood.
Potentially?
Well, it depends. See, that's true, because it all depends on where you are in it. And, you know, it's you're the ultimate guide or the ultimate answer to that. But
okay, the reason that I'm not giving you a very direct response is because if you get a concept of it based on a very initial fleeting expression, and then you take that concept for the goal, you can become misguided.
Oh.
It's important for you to stay open to experience and to have a lot of small experiences that are all just a little bit different, that begin to broaden the field of your awareness in different directions. It's like you have one small experience and you're already wanting to narrow the path, and the path needs to be expanded as well.
Interesting. Thank you. Okay.
So did anybody else, or Mike, did this help answer anything to do with your email?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Do you have anything to say about that?
Just the fact that when we choose to do something based on a habit pattern or the pressure of attraction and repulsion.
There you go.
Then, you know, that is a moment, a taste of a kind of different, well, I sometimes call a moment of relative freedom or whatever.
Yeah. And we hear the phrase in some of the other literature, a moment of freedom. And that would be, if we can do that properly, we're expressing a moment of freedom, which is exercising being in the space called the non-phenomenal self, or that unity. And it's just exercising it. So we're turning our attention, our intention, we're growing it. And every time you do it, it's like one more penny in the bank. And that's not a bad thing. So it does build up.
It's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, and then you can actually buy a hamburger.
Veggie burger. Okay, so I'd like to move on to one small habit, unless someone has something else they'd like to add to this conversation. If so, jump in. And one comment that I'd like to make is that there's a distinction, I think, between the exercise in harmless whim and the exercise in one small habit, is that in harmless whim, we're importing the habit, and in one small habit, we're working with something that's pre-existing inside the machine. That being said, and not getting any objection from anyone, we'll start with one small habit. As we struggle with the machine, beginning with one small habit, we can produce an alchemical fire in the machine's chemical factory, which will gradually transform our being.
Okay. So I just want to reaffirm Teresa's distinction there between the one small whim, one small habit, and that the whim exercise can be huge. And in fact, you can take it on all the time. You can, as you're walking through the supermarket and you see something that you want to copy or do, maybe it's a change in the way you walk, your cadence becomes slightly different. Maybe you hold your hand slightly different. You look, and when you do that, you start to see that you actually can be free. You can be, and then it's like an adventure, no matter where you are, where you go. And it's just a kick. It really is. So, one small habit, she says.
Hey, David T., can I ask you guys to give give an example
of a habit?
Activity? Yep.
The whim or the small habit?
Because I'd like to understand, you talk about invoking this freedom and invoking this alchemical reaction. I sort of understand the differences. It's somebody else's habit versus my own. I would like an example of completion of a harmless whim and completion of one small habit, and then that would help me understand a little bit more.
For me, a harmless whim, this is one example of many that I do, but one harmless whim that I took on because it was so funny. A movie called Dream a Little Dream. It's an old movie. And one of the characters in it, when he made his point, would hold his index finger up in a certain way, and the way he would, and then get into a certain cadence with the way he talked. And like I'm doing that right now. So if I was on the TV, you'd see it. And it's just, it's a funny thing to adopt. And so it's not mine, certainly nothing that I did, but sometimes it's appropriate and I grab that and I do that. Mm-hmm. But it's become more fluid for me now, Diane. I do it a lot.
Oh,
and okay. I'll do a lot of different things as I'm marching along through life.
Okay.
I have a great evil description of the difference between the two.
Okay.
So when David says, "That's all," it's a habit. If I started to say it intentionally, it would be a whim. When you and I say it accidentally because we've been listening to David on the calls, that's a habit.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Say that. Do me a favor, T. Can you say that again? I like that.
I'll let David tell you if he's
okay,
wants
David,
to.
David, go ahead.
Well, what I heard TD say was that I guess I use a phrase sometimes. What is it?
That's all.
You know
That's
very
all.
Well.
But it is like a mechanical thing to me. It's part of a signature. So that's all, and I'll just conclude in that manner. And so Teresa, in these conversations, sometimes she picked it up. She says, "I'm gonna duplicate that." So she started duplicating it, and lo and behold, it got captured by the sleeping machine and became a small habit for her.
Yeah, well, I heard Diana say it in our last session. And she didn't even realize that she was doing it. And I knew exactly where she got it.
So once again, there's intentionality when we're adopting a small whim, right?
Right.
And there is mechanicality when we're experiencing our small habit.
Oh, got it.
Does that help a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. So my question then is, what is the key in chapter number 9, one small habit, what is it meant when he says the alchemical fire?
Just a second. Right on track with what we're talking about, Townsy Girl Lee. So it sounds like the habit is something the machine does when asleep, and by being aware of it and maybe change it and make it intentional?
Yeah, in other words, you can grab your own habit potentially. And as
Hello?
I'm here.
And then somebody's got some background noise, and can they mute out, please? Silverdale added, the non-phenomenal self, when developed, experiences itself as a vibratory sensation. The first whimsical habit to attempt to develop is to experience this vibratory sensation, first in one location in the body, and then throughout the whole body.
Okay. So with Silverdale, and this is, at some point we're going to have to go through the book called HBM again. Because what Silverdale is talking about there is this concept that's in HBM, Human Biological Machine, as a transformational apparatus. In that book, E.J. Gold talks about the idea of sensing. So we sense the fact, hey, right now, And you can do it right this second if you bring forth this special attention. If you bring it forth right now, and then you sense that vibratory feeling and where it might have a locale in the body. Okay? That is not mechanical.
I have a comment also, still answering, Diana, your question about examples. You asked if we had examples. I'll tell you an example. I believe it's an example. One thing that I've been doing lately, which also applies, I think, to the alchemical fire, which David was and hopefully still is about to go into, I begin to work with my breath to some extent in changing my breathing patterns. And breathing is something that's so automatic and so mechanical, and yet it's something that one can change with attention fairly easily. Of course, like all of the rest of the work, the problem is remembering to bring the attention to it. So when one breathes, it's very interesting because the way one breathes directly alters consciousness, and therefore it has an alchemy to it. The movement of the diaphragm in specific, transfers psychic or emotional tensions to the physical body itself. It's through the breath that those tensions begin to transfer. And so working with the breath, interestingly enough, seems to bring up different emotional issues or different experiences and different sensations in the body and in the machine than, in this case that I can access when I breathe in the way that I normally breathe. And so in working with the breath, different aspects are stirred up and then some are calmed down, and it's a different experience of self. So in working with that habit of breath, it begins to create alchemical changes in the body. Now that may or may not be what EJ was talking about, but by the alchemical fire, but I think it's pertinent and interesting.
Hey, then maybe this is something I've been working on. I was at this Mia class, and we were sort of examining body mapping. And one of the instructors pointed to the fact that I tend to lock my knees. And I was never attentive to the fact that I do this. So for the past 4 days, ever since I returned from that seminar, I find oftentimes when I'm standing somewhere, especially if I'm uncomfortable, and I don't mean physically uncomfortable, but uncomfortable with the situation or who I am at that moment, that I tend to seize up my knees and freeze up.
That's a good observation. I've noticed in clinical practice that every client so far that I've had who locks their knees does it as part of a dissociative process that brings them out into the mind rather than down into the body and feeling. And they feel distant from people. And as soon as they unlock the knees, they feel much more immediately present and available for connection.
Son of a gun. Okay.
Now, Silverdale has a comment. This vibratory sensation is what awakens the machine and the historical personality. Once fully functional, then the third force of our personal trinity can be developed and established by blending the first two forces, that is, the non-phenomenal self and the awakened machine.
And I think we're going to get into that a little bit in this chapter, One Small Habit. There's a lot here, it's a worthy work, because we are the laboratory. And in passing, you mentioned the word attention, and this is a powerful powerful tool, the development of our attention. We already think we have a lot of attention, but once you begin down this path, you begin to realize how utterly limited our attention is, and a whole fresh vista opens up when we begin developing this brand new attention. But I pose the question to the class once again, what is meant by an alchemical fire? And maybe others can answer for the moment.
Why don't you answer and then someone can chime in if they show up.
I'm excited to hear other people's voices on this particular point, but I'll
okay, Silverdale made a comment, and I'm excited to hear his too. Sama wanted the question repeated. Sama, the question is, what is an alchemical fire? And Silverdale says, an alchemical fire is nothing more than the degree of vibratory sensation the non-phenomenal self is experiencing.
So... Have you ever tried to start a fire? Just a regular fire with wood? Anybody? Yes, no, maybe so?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay, so a few yeses, maybe.
Townsy girl, would that be an intentional activation of a chemical response in the machine with the use of will?
Well... I hesitate because of the term chemical versus alchemical, but I'm not sure if I have the ability to fully address that distinction. But right now we're talking about this vibratory sensation. When you go to start a fire, you use, like you use kindling. Very small little pieces of wood. And now there's the old thing about, you know, you rub two pieces of wood together and it starts to create heat, and then you can get a spark from that with some very, very fine paper or something like that. And then that little spark starts enough of a fire that maybe some of the kindling can get started. And if you are careful and attentive to that, and you maintain the elements that are required in a fire, fuel, heat, oxygen, then the fire can maintain. And if it continues to maintain, then you can put a real piece of wood on there. So, what is it that you need to do to rub? What is it you're rubbing together to create the first elements of that fire that creates the beginning elements of heat? Right in the book. You just have to read our text.
Townsy girl, the will and the phenomenal self?
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'd like to throw in a couple of sorcerers.
Yeah.
There's a chapter called The Struggle of Sorcerers that we did a couple of times ago.
Yeah, you'll find that they taste like chicken.
She's laughing.
Okay. All
right. But you have to start the fire to cook them.
But has to be a pretty warm fire, I'll tell you.
And then says in a transformational process involving the friction caused by our observation. Nicely said, and nice to have you back tonight.
There it is.
Sama, irritation or friction to the personality. Good, yeah.
And that's correct. And it's only caused when we begin the process of the struggle to observe the habits of the machine.
Because when we're having all this friction or irritation, if we're dissociating and we're not paying attention to it and we're not trying to notice ourselves, or there's no self-observation present, that energy is wasted and we're having distress or even suffering for nothing. It's just expended vital force. Whereas when we're using that same stimulus and the same situation to awaken ourselves by observing ourselves carefully, bringing the source of attention to those behaviors, then that same irritation, friction, or even suffering can become an asset to personal and spiritual work.
So we regain it. We regain that piece of property, that real estate. That energy, we regain it for ourselves at that point.
So, do we want to move on into the chapter at this point?
Well, I dug right into it. I went to page 93. I'm still on One Small Habit, right?
Yes.
Oh, and I want to point out that in that, on the bottom of page 92 of that chapter, it says, a work circle is useful for this, this being the observation of tiny little unconscious habitual expressions. And in addition to the ones that were mentioned about my speech patterns, four pauses, very pleased to point out that I also use the term what. We appreciate that. Okay?
I have a question from on page 92, actually, if that's all right.
Good. Good.
Even though as non-phenomenal beings we have no direct will over the machine, at least in the beginning, we can enlist the aid of the mental centrum in the tail brain. A small exact change can produce corresponding changes in the ordinarily inaccessible monasteries of the reflexive feeling and thinking centrums. I would like to know more about enlisting the aid of the centrum in the tail brain. That sounds like an interesting exercise or practice of attention that could be useful, and maybe somebody else knows more about that than I do, like Silverdale's just posted a comment. Our attention, while one unity is fragmented by multiplicity and diversity and ongoing division, we strive to consciously and intentionally divide and separate our attention equally among the three forces and thus minimize the fragmented state. Okay, I'm still, it's a good comment as always. I'm still dying to know more about how to enlist the aid of the mental centrum in the tail brain. I have some notions, but I have access to those all the time. Anybody else have some?
Too late. What are your notions?
One third of our attention is located in our head. One third of our attention is located in our tail brain, and the third force is located in our solar plexus. Useful and interesting. Now, how do we activate the mental centrum in the tail brain? I think I activated it a little bit this morning by somewhat by accident when I was doing some breathing exercises. And I was breathing and using my, I was trying to use different muscles than I normally breathe with, particularly to use the side ribs and the side ribs in the back. And all of a sudden I got some really specific sensation that went right down into the tailbone, and the sensations in the tailbone seemed to awaken and then spread up the outside of the back and then ultimately over my head and back down the front. But that was more vague. The tail brain seemed to, or the tailbone center seemed to awaken as I was able to bring my attention into the area in a certain way. Now, whether that was just tailbone energy center, which in Qigong is called the marrow gate, or whether that's the mental centrum in the tail brain, that's what I don't know. And so I get another comment here. We try to excite a vibratory sensation in accordance with our gender, usually by using our imagination until it becomes habitual by instinct. Yeah, can you say more about that, Silverdale? Would you be willing to get on the phone for a minute? If you're not, just type no. But if you are, I'd be love to talk about this topic a little more directly. I don't see any no, so he might show up momentarily. But it might take...
Well,
pardon me?
Yeah, Teresa, I'm here.
Oh, great. Do you know what he means by enlisting the aid of the mental centrum and the tail brain? Thanks for coming on the line.
Yeah. Well, look, at you know, this is a highly, it's highly embarrassing to offer a specific explanation.
Yeah, I know. I embarrass myself on every call.
And it's because you have to, you know, look, you have to have a lot of background to understand, you know, all of these ideas arise out of Gurdjieff, the foundation that Gurdjieff himself laid down. And so what I'm offering is simply the conclusions I've arrived at after, you know, as I've mentioned before.
They're wonderful and thought-provoking, and I think we all appreciate them greatly. I know I do.
Well, look at, okay, you know, this idea of the mental centrum in the tail brain is really the Gurdjieffian way of talking about Kundalini. Now, Gurdjieff criticizes all explanations about, you know, Kundalini in all other traditions, because he doesn't think that they know really what they're talking about. They're just talking about something in general. But what Gurdjieff says in offering his own explanation is that sexual power is that sexual power in the tail brain. Really, he's talking about tail brain, think sexual powers. How do you harness that for your own personal benefit, since that is the residence of your non-phenomenal self? And the answer to that is you create a vibratory sensation there initially by just imagining it's already there. Over time, it actually seems to have an arising because you've been observing it, almost like magic. And then what you discover is that that vibratory sensation has the ability to think.
Oh, okay.
Has the ability to think independently of whatever your head happens to be thinking about. I mean, these are, you know, it's like a woman will be thinking and a man will be thinking. They might be looking at the same things, but they'll be thinking different things. And so that's what that mental centrum in the tail brain is. Once that becomes the primary source, you know, once that is the once that becomes the initiating gravity, center of gravity, and the head brain becomes the secondary center of gravity, then that third source of gravity, that third centrum in the solar plexus awakens, and then you have genuine being.
Do you think that this capacity of awakening that tailbrain center, the thought of the awakening that tailbone center, is what extremely advanced martial artists are doing when they're able to, say, take on 9 opponents at the same time, and they sort of slow down time and they are able to know exactly what to do next? Would you call that tailbrain thinking?
Listen, I've not reached that state myself, but I believe that would be the logical destination of the path that I'm on. That is, once that tailbrain is accelerated, you know, you're talking about accelerating your vibratory sensations so that all the world around you becomes nothing more than frozen. And once it's frozen, then just like in slow motion, although for everybody else it's just the flow of time, you're able to do any. You can. It's like looking at a motion. A motion picture is a series of frames moving at a certain speed. Once you accelerate your vibratory sensation to that level, as these martial artists apparently would do, then what you're doing is you're actually taking advantage of the space between frames to decide what the next frame is going to do and how you want to change it.
I had that experience before in an auto accident. I think some people have those experiences in auto accidents.
Okay, so when you had that experience in the auto accident, exactly what was going on then?
At what level?
Well, not with the car and stuff, but with your attention and this concept of slowing down.
Well, the time, something that happened in only a couple seconds felt like it took like 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes. It's like I had a running guidance, do this, do that, do this. And it was thought, but it was absolutely direct, and it all had to do with what had to happen with my body. Turn the wheel that way. Take your foot off of the brake. Look behind you. See this car's over there. Steer that way. I had to go back and forth across the road twice in and out of traffic, and I missed all of them and intentionally put it into a tree instead of a parked car. And it all happened in a couple seconds, but I was getting directions blow by blow.
Yeah, and I think that should be the normal state for all of us in every moment of life.
My question, Silverdale and Teresa, is what was happening there from the point of view of our practical work on self and human biological machine? What was different in that moment?
Absolutely focused self-observation without any distractions whatsoever.
Yeah. Your attention was catapulted to another level. Catapulted to another level, and all that was unfolding in front of you was suddenly you saw all of the elements, and it was just like in a motion picture, and you were watching the frames flicker by. And that's what's occurring. So we can become like martial artists, like what we see on TV, on the movies, and Kung Fu and Kwai Chang Kane and all those guys. We can do the same thing exactly as we develop our attention. Those guys that are doing that have hundreds of hours upon hundreds of hours of practice. It doesn't just happen that, oh, they can do that.
And the practice is all direct attention to the body and to sensation. That's the type of practice it is, because my Qigong teacher, Dr. Sun, I know he is in that state. And I mean, he's taken on 6 attackers before and things like that, lots of things. And he's also talked the solar plexus center, which he calls the wisdom gate. And there's a lot of wisdom, like universal wisdom, that's accessed through that solar plexus center. So he intentionally works on developing those two centers.
Yeah, so we can do exactly the same thing. All we need to do is spend the same amount of time with our attention on these matters.
That's a good point. Zazen called that machine override, though. I didn't want to get too past that. It was such a great comment. And
yeah,
machine override was a good term for it. It's like the machine decided that it was going to stay alive, and it decided to do all the thinking.
So every time that you invoke this struggle to observe the machine, you're slowing time down. And something strange happens. Reality before you literally starts to change.
Yep.
It's different.
Yep.
I believe this literally. Is some reason. I'm sorry. One of the reasons why some veterans report that they really had a heightened experience of being alive and being present in war, in battle, and direct combat that they were not able to attain in ordinary life, which can sometimes account for some of the depression.
And because they don't have the training, they don't have the foundation that we're talking about right now. The skill level... I don't know if people have shot guns before, but a lot happens in the body when you do that. And I've not shot guns in a combat situation, but to be able to hold attention during that kind of onslaught takes a lot of training. So we're talking about training bit by bit here, bit by bit, as it says, to get ourselves to a point where we have a little more foothold on intentionality of our will.
So we have machine override. I kept talking over you. I apologize. We have machine override in these life or death situations, and it might give us a tiny glimpse, but the real art form to the practice is being able to maintain that level of awakeness in ordinary life under the most supposedly boring of circumstances.
Exactly. And I guarantee you, in the most boring of circumstances, and I highlight and underline that word because we're so desperate never to be bored, if you activate your attention, you will never be bored. You might decide there's maybe more other things you want to do, but you definitely won't be bored. So this is the unglamorous part of inner martial arts training. The unglamorous part of it, it takes these little steps over and over and over again. And, you know, you think, oh, I'll never get there. I'll never be able to play the violin. And suddenly something happens. But it's only the suddenly something happens only after a great deal of time. And the more you put yourself in circumstances that stretches you into new environments, the more exercise of that you get, the more exciting it is. So, can you put yourself in situations, for instance, maybe you have you're afraid of leading a class, and then you're put in a position where you need to do that. You're desperately certain that you can't do it. And then suddenly you're doing it. So that would be, I don't know if there's a chapter on that, but that's not one small habit.
you commit yourself beyond your limitations and you're given help in that moment.
Can you say that
again? I really believe that. I believe that, Mike. I think that that's so true. But, man, you got to put yourself in that. You have to throw yourself ahead of yourself, right?
Yeah. Nobody wants to do that, of course.
But I'll tell you, once you start down the path, sometimes you get a sniff of a little door starting to open up, and you spin, and you rush toward it because that opportunity is there. Recently, I myself have put myself in, I've been in several situations that are not desirable, that I don't want to be in a machine comfortable habit point of view, but I guarantee you I was compelled to move forward. Okay? I was compelled to move forward because it put me in a position that I know I am over my head. I guarantee you I am over my head. And both are the ones I'm thinking of.
I sometimes think of that as putting myself under tension, you know, and it's kind of like the alchemical fire.
Yep.
And observing the machine under the influence of the alchemical fire or the creative tension of putting yourself in a situation where you don't want, you know, there's fear or whatever. It's like stage fright becomes stage presence if you're able to be there, breathe, and trust.
Yeah.
So
I like that.
Sarma was saying, create the need for the ability, and that's a big piece of it, too.
Yeah, and we talked a lot in when we were doing HBM about the idea of necessity. Placing yourself, you know, in such a situation where necessity is at hand. There's an interesting quote that EJ gave us some time ago, and it's, how can you put yourself in a position where your transformation is a necessity for the work? So.
Mark Roach said, like being thrown in the water and having to learn to swim real quick. I had a... go ahead.
Or learn how to breathe water.
Yes, like that. I had a situation where I had a virus in my brain lining and for a number of months, and I couldn't do cognitive processes because it was impacting my left brain. And I had to think seriously about quitting my practice. And I began to sit in with my clients and just kind of my guidance system started kicking in and said, no, don't quit. And I didn't know what to do. And I would sit there and kind of pray for guidance. And I started bypassing all of the protocols that I did in order to come much more directly to what the client needed. My intuition began to wake up. I began to sit there and try and look, what is the highest priority that this person has in their system, mental, emotional, physical, energetic. And I would sit and talk to people for a few minutes, and I found that I started to work four times as quickly. And then after I got better, then I was able to use, you know, go back and forth between the intuitive and the cognitive, but not until after the intuition had been trained in that manner. That was like being thrown in the water and having to learn to swim real quick.
Diana, are you still on?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
This is going to be a little strange for a moment, but I'd like to ask you a question about being a CPA.
Okay.
You remember that?
Thank you. I've been trying to dump it, but go ahead.
Vaguely. Did you ever do an audit of a financial statement?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, you had to, of course. And when you did the audit, you'd go to a client, let's say, that, and you'd audit a particular, maybe let's say, inventory. And you'd audit to see if it was in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And then you'd be sitting there counting it, or you'd be, verifying FIFO layering or something like that. But the point is that when you were doing that work, it was very mundane, right?
Correct.
But what you were actually doing is you were bringing a principle, that principle of accounting or auditing, into that moment. And that's what we need to do here, too, is we need to, in our day-to-day lives, bring these principles of waking up into how I interact with the people I work with, or how I interact with the bus driver, or whoever, you know, whatever event you're involved in. What's the principle you're bringing to bear at that moment?